From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Trade talks between the U.S. and China have wrapped up for the day. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said they were constructive, but there is no deal yet. And now the trade war between those two countries has hit a full boil. At midnight, the U.S. increased tariffs from 10% to 25% on $200 billion of Chinese imports. And yesterday, President Trump threatened to impose another round after that, meaning nearly everything that China sends to the U.S. would be taxed. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
So the Chinese going home apparently without a deal. What happened today? What are the sticking points?
Well, one of the main sticking points is that the Trump administration really wants China to codify its concessions in these trade negotiations into official law in the country. And China instead wants to just let the government officials sort of handle it without actually enforcing laws or writing new laws, rather. So that's one of the main sticking points, but there are several others.
All right. So for now, the tariffs that went up to 25% early this morning, they're still on. I guess there was some hope that they would go away if they could come away with a deal today. But just remind us what's getting more expensive.
Right. So it's a very long list of goods, some 5,700 different product categories. Some of them are very obscure, almost comically so. Like my favorite is dried shark fins, whether or not salted, but not smoked.
Not going to affect me.
Me neither. But there are a lot of everyday items too. Soy sauce being one, tilapia fillets, certain kinds of gloves, luggage, even Christmas lights. So it's a wide variety of goods.
Markets are down today. They do not like the idea of new tariffs. But for the most part, the trade war that we've seen really hasn't trickled down to the consumers. Are we getting to a point where that's going to change?
Well, this depends on how long these latest set of tariffs stay on the books and whether or not President Trump follows through with plans to tariff everything else that's being imported from China. The first round of this set of goods was 10%. So to go from 10% to 25% is a pretty big jump.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you add in everything else that we import from China, it potentially is a worrying sign.
The president said yesterday that the tariffs bring in billions of dollars to the U.S. government. But that's a little confusing. Can you explain that? Because ultimately, isn't it the consumers, you and I, who go to the store and buy things that are going to be paying more?
Absolutely. That's what most of the studies have shown is that the cost of the tariffs have mostly been borne by the consumers. Now, inflation throughout the country is pretty mild, so it hasn't really caused a huge pickup in inflation. But again, if you take these tariffs from 10% to 25%, there is the potential for more inflation, obviously, and for, frankly, some shortage of goods that people need.
Okay. What about China? Officials there say they are ready to retaliate. On the other hand, China does not import as much from the United States. So it's pretty clear they don't have as much leverage. What can they do?
Well, not as far as a tariff one-for-one retaliation, but the question of how they will retaliate really is top of mind for everyone on Wall Street right now. What they did last time was, in some cases, they slowed the customs inspections of imports from the United States, and they stepped up regulatory scrutiny of American companies that are operating in China.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other things they could do, too. They could allow their currency to weaken very aggressively, and that would make their products more competitive on a price basis. And they could simply choose to do more business with other countries and just import less from the U.S., regardless of what the tariffs are on the goods they're importing.
Steve Mnuchin said talks were constructive, so we will see. Maybe there's more to go on this story. We're going to keep an eye on that. But before I let you go, Uber made its debut on Wall Street today, priced at $45 a share, a little bit lower than expected. Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi explained it this way on CNBC.
We thought that at this price, it reflected the environment. And listen, the environment is uncertain right now. And any time there's uncertainty in the market, investors are going to be a little hesitant to put $8 billion of their dollars to work.
Uncertain, maybe because Uber drivers around the world went on strike protesting their pay and working conditions. Quickly, what obstacles are ahead for Uber?
Well, I think Derek Sershari hit it the nail on the head. This risk aversion in markets right now is not good for a company like Uber that is losing money. Investors are, you know, going to be hesitant to invest in a company that's losing money when markets are behaving the way they are right now.
All right. Michael Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for more on the Uber IPO and the trade war with China, let's bring in Drew Bernstein, who's co-founder and managing partner of Markham, Bernstein and Pinchuk. He joins us from New York. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and how concerned are you about the increase in tariffs on Chinese imports today?
Well, as an American, I'm concerned because the price of the goods that we pay. So it comes right back at us, and, you know, trade wars are never good things. But I believe there will be an impact to the U.S. investors because we read about it every day in the papers, and it has an effect on the sentiment, you know, here. I think the biggest challenge for the Chinese companies is not producing the revenue growth. You know, today, investors are not as concerned with dividends. You know, they're looking for growth. So the real question is, are they going to be able to close the credibility gap and demonstrate how they can sustain the growth and show how they can turn a profit?
Do you think that the trade war right now is driving the U.S. stock market more than any other single thing?
No, because I think most of the investors, especially the China savvy investors, understand that it's not going to have a great impact on the economy right now.
How can that be, though? Because you've got the two largest economies in the world fighting with each other and raising the price of each other's goods. How could it not have a big impact?
Well, one, it's not really affecting the price of goods in China because this has been going on for a while right now. And I always looked at China and the U.S. as sort of like a marriage. We fight with them, but not aggressively, and we really can't afford to get divorced.
And yet we're in a pretty big fight right now, and it looks like there could be a divorce.
I don't think so. I think that, you know, eventually things are going to work out. China doesn't like to fight. They like to use their influence, and they have pretty grand plans in building their economy.
You spend a lot of time dealing with business people both here and in China. One of the things I've always heard about Chinese companies is that it's sometimes difficult to know whether you can trust the numbers that they are offering up, that investors should be very careful doing business with China. Is that still the case?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things I preach literally to Chinese companies is that if you want to be a successful company, you better own 80% of the investor's confidence and trust. That's critical. That's one of the big questions, I think, with these unicorn companies. And a unicorn, by definition, refers to companies basically with market caps or values over $1 billion. Mm-hmm. But also one of the characteristics of unicorns is that they're industry disruptive. Uber is obviously a unicorn.
Right. Facebook, also a unicorn.
Correct. In, I think, 2013, there was probably about 30, 35 unicorns at that time. And fast forward 6 years later, and there's over 10 times that. And it's this kind of phenomenon because a unicorn is something that's supposed to be rare, right? If I told you there's a unicorn running around, everybody would be scouring. And it's no different right now in the markets. So I think the real question is going to be, are they able to present business plans that can demonstrate sustainability and a balance between growth and profitability?
One more thing I want to ask you about, because you do a lot of business with China, do you think that the tariffs right now are turning off Chinese investors and making them less likely to spend their money in the United States?
I don't really think so. You know, the media in China obviously is government controlled. And, you know, during my time in China, even about 6 or 7 weeks ago when the tariffs were still up on the top of the list, you didn't really read that much about it because it didn't affect that many companies. And, you know, the United States to the Chinese right now is kind of a special place. And you see their kids coming to school here. You see a lot of immigration from China because some of the social conditions, although China has a lot of reserves as cash, their improvements into the social system, I think, drives many people out of China. One of the major challenges, I think, also right now is the lack of intellectual property protection. So I don't really think that the tariffs are really going to alter very much.
That is Drew Bernstein, who is with the accounting and advisory firm Markham, Bernstein & Pinchuk. Thanks so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you very much for the opportunity.
The Simpsons wraps up its 30th season this Sunday. That's right, it has been 3 decades since The Simpsons changed from a rough collection of clips...
That's the last time I ever take you kids to the zoo.
Calm down, Homer.
...to the lunk-headed family everyone knows and loves.
2, 4, 6, 8. I hate stamps. They aren't great.
The Simpsons started as a series of short cartoons on The Tracey Ullman Show, but when it became its own show in 1989... a historically popular program was born. Here's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
1445, can we get shrieks from Homer when she's nearly stepping on his foot?
It's Tuesday, sound mixing night for Simpsons showrunner Al Jean and creator Matt Groening. They're sitting in a studio with the program's sound and music editors.
Actually, I think this is one of the most interesting parts of the process.
After 30 years, Matt Groening still loves amping up the funny in an episode by tweaking the sound mix, usually just by making noises louder. In one telling moment, Groening makes the scene funnier by turning up the sound of Homer Simpson breaking his back while dancing.
Well, one of the things we say is more pain, more funny. The sound of pain is much more funny than the sound of pain giving.
Groening remembers struggling years ago to mix a scene with Homer fighting another character, Waylon Smithers. They tried mixing in all kinds of different sounds, and then...
We took out all of the sounds of aggression and only left in the sounds of pain.
Stop fighting like a girl, Simpson.
Okay. No!
And suddenly it was hilarious. We are a sick culture.
Groening and his colleagues have taken advantage of that sick culture to make TV history. The Simpsons is now the longest-running scripted series in American primetime TV. But wait a minute. Let's go back to when this all started, in the mid-1980s. Groening met producer James L. Brooks. Now, Brooks created programs like The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Taxi. He wanted to develop an animated version of Groening's popular comic strip, Life in Hell, to run on The Tracey Ullman Show. But as Groening sat in the waiting room of Brooks's office, he got worried.
I realized that I would probably lose control of whatever came out of this deal, and the Fox network, this isn't going to go anywhere. This is going to last a few months, and it's going to go down the tubes. That's what everybody was saying. And I didn't want to ruin my good gig with my weekly comic strip. So on the spot, in the waiting room, I drew The Simpsons for the first time.
Groening named them after his family, except for Bart. The Simpsons were slow-witted Homer, gravelly-voiced Marge, bratty kids Bart and Lisa, and baby Maggie. The characters were first featured in short scenes that aired in between sketches on The Ullman Show, starting in 1987.
Hold on, there's no need to slurp your soup so loudly.
She's right, you little slobs.
Dad often tried to strangle his son, and they ate dinner in front of the TV. It wasn't just a satire of the American family. It was a satire of TV itself. As the characters got more popular, James Brooks said they used clips of The Simpsons in between taping sketches for The Ullman Show.
And we put them together as entertainment for the audience to hold them there, you know, while we got ready. And a lot of nights, the big laughs were for that.
That reaction sparked an idea, giving The Simpsons their own show. But when Fox suggested a single Christmas special, Groening told Brooks to ask for 13 episodes instead.
I always thought, and Jim agreed, that it might take the audience a few episodes to get into the show. So they came back to Jim and said, how about 2 specials? And Jim said no. And they said, how about 4 episodes? And Jim said no. And we went for the 13.
Jim Brooks notes this was a delicate time for a very new Fox network.
The network at that time was hanging on by a thread. I mean, it was you know, really on the verge of bankruptcy then. And we held out for 13 shows, which for them at the time represented an enormous investment.
Groening, Brooks, and showrunner Sam Simon became the architects of the series. Current showrunner Al Jean was among the first writers hired for the show. He said the Simpsons were a little meaner in the Ullman shorts.
Homer in the shorts was kind of angry and got a little dumber, although we try to keep him from being too dumb. That's always like a warning flag for us. In the shorts, Lisa and Bart were both kind of hellraisers. Lisa, you know, in the series became the intellectual and sadder and a little deeper.
But there was one big problem. The animation for the first episode they planned to air looked terrible. Groening first saw it at an animation studio with a documentary film crew in tow.
I'm looking at this while the cameras are rolling, and it's the worst animation. I could not believe it. And I'm there to promote this new, brand new show, and the animation is all weirdly rubbery and charmless. And I'm going, hey, that's great.
Eventually, they decided to air a different episode first on December 17th, 1989, a Christmas story titled Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. Mimi Pond, a cartoonist and TV writer friend of Groening's, wrote it as a freelancer and saw it extensively rewritten. But she was still excited.
It was thrilling for me to be part of this new thing, and I knew it was going to be a really big stinking deal. And I was given a crew jacket and I was wearing it on the subway in New York, and everyone was like, oh my God, where did you get that? I want that. And I was like, this is going to be so big. I just didn't know it was going to take off without me.
Pond later learned she wouldn't be hired on the first season's writing staff, which was all male. Years later, she heard rumors that Sam Simon didn't want female writers, but that's something showrunner Al Jean disputes. Simon, who left the show in 1993, died in 2015 after a long battle with cancer. Al Jean says things have changed. Of the show's 23 episodes this year,
I believe 10 are written by women. I wish it was more. I'm glad it's not less. I mean, we're trying to do our best.
I asked Matt Groening how the show has thrived for so long. He says the key is finding bold new ways to mine comedy out of a structure they built 30 years ago.
Some people are going, well, it's not the same as it was in season 4 or season 7. You're right. It isn't. But if it had remained the same, I don't think we'd be here today.
Couple that evolution with characters who never age and an audience who has literally grown up with the show, and you have an audacious experiment which has become a TV institution. I'm Eric Deggans.
Okay, let's get back to politics. One of the president's tweets this week made a big splash in Indian country. On Wednesday morning, President Trump urged Republicans to vote no on House Resolution 312. He called it a special interest casino bill backed by his longtime foe, Senator Elizabeth Warren. The bill would have protected the reservation status of land owned by the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts after a Trump administration ruling last fall that the tribe was not eligible to have a reservation. Within hours of the president's tweets, House Democrats pulled the measure from the House floor to prevent it from getting voted down. Jordan Bennett Begay is a reporter for Indian Country Today. Jordan, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure, and the president called this a casino bill. It is true that it would allow the Mashpee Wampanoag to build a new casino, but the tribe would say it's about something much more than that. Can you explain what the bill would have done for Mashpee Wampanoag?
Yes, so the bill would have reaffirmed that their land is taken into trust because in 2015, Obama signed another bill that would protect this land for the Mashpee. And it is, you know, of course, there's a casino that's part of this bill, but it's also a piece of land for their government and for a language immersion school, and just comes with addressing other like Indian issues and also upholding and holding like government accountable for their trust responsibility toward Native tribes. So it's much more than that, and upholding, you know, foremost tribal sovereignty and respecting the Mashpee sovereignty.
If the land is not in trust, does that mean that the tribe has essentially lost its reservation?
It's murky territory, and overall it threatens, you know, tribal sovereignty for the tribe and also other tribes in Indian country. And it's pretty much like what people dubbed it as this is a new termination era or the extermination era where they're trying to get rid of us. And during that time, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, it was just a very dangerous time because that's when a lot of like the relocation acts were going on. So it's much more than what the president has tweeted right now.
All right, I want to play a clip from Donald Trump, and this was before he was president back in 1993. He was testifying in Congress in opposition to another East Coast tribes casino project, but this time it was the Mashantucket Pequot.
I will tell you right now, they don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like the Indians. Now, maybe we say politically correct or not politically correct. They don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like Indians to Indians. And a lot of people are laughing at it, and you're telling how tough it is, how rough it is to get approved. Well, you go up to Connecticut, and you look. Now, they don't look like Indians to me, sir.
Okay, so this is not entirely new territory for the president, but there is some reporting that President Trump's position on this bill aligns with a lobbyist who's married to one of his top White House staffers and who also represents the owners of a competing casino in nearby Rhode Island. What can you tell us about that?
You know, it is evident throughout different reports that he does have history with Native American casinos, because, you know, they're going to compete. And I think he knows that they're so successful, and he's threatened by that all over the country. But also, I think in that, like, he's also misinformed about, you know, what Native Americans look like.
Right. Well, he's had some history, just the way he calls Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, which he did again this week. How do people in Indian country feel about President Trump generally?
Oh, man, we're all over the spectrum here, too. But mostly what I'm seeing, like, on social media is, one, that tweet was a racial slur, and people were very upset by it. And they're also taking it as an opportunity to educate. You know, he's misinformed. And that's what Representative Tom Cole said, who is Chickasaw. And he said the same thing, that representatives are misinformed and they need to educate themselves.
Tom Cole, a congressman from Oklahoma. Jordan Bennett Begay, a reporter and producer for Indian Country Today. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Have a good one.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
When you're reading a news story online about North Korea, how does it make you feel? What about when you're reading a story about space exploration? I ask because a number of media organizations, including USA Today and the New York Times, have been investing in new technologies targeting digital ads according to the emotions that the editorial content evokes. And now they're expanding that approach. Here Now media analyst John Carroll joins us to explain. Hi, John.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what's the thinking behind this?
Okay, so the Times moves more and more toward a subscription-driven revenue model. And as they do that, they have 4.5 million subscriptions now. As they do that, they want to be seen as protecting their reader data, not exploiting it and capitalizing on it. So what they've done is they launched the pilot program last year called Project Feels, where they basically look at the editorial content and say, what kind of emotion is this going to evoke? They have 18 of them, actually, that they track. And then they try to match an advertiser's pitch to the emotion that that they think the content will produce.
Because then they're not using the data that they've got on you to figure out what to advertise to you, but rather they're looking at the story that you're reading.
Exactly. So the advertiser is targeting the story and the effect of the story, not the reader's data history or browsing history, none of that. Because they're paying, and the Times doesn't want to be seen to be exploiting that data. Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, a travel company would want its ad adjacent to a piece that evokes, say, adventurousness and self-confidence.
Right, right. And the way they figured out what the emotions are, they crowdsourced them, basically. They got a group of volunteers. They gave them the 18 emotions, and they said, assign these, one of these, two of these, to this content that we're showing you. And what they did was, from that data, they built a predictive algorithm that lets them basically figure out future stories.
And now they're expanding this. How?
Right. They're expanding it into two different areas. One is topic targeting. So basically immigration, technology, and you can say, I just want to be attached to technology content. The other is motivational targeting, which is seeing content that would possibly lead someone to take an action and matching that up with an advertiser's objectives.
And the Times is saying that this new type of targeting has increased click-through rates by 40%.
Right. And you know, basically, it's more engaging. There were about 50 campaigns in the pilot program, and they said, you know, they were happy with it. So they're rolling out the emotional targeting even wider now. But just not to get technical, but average click-through rate is 0.4%. Mm. So 40% increase on that is not a huge gain.
And so does this approach have benefits for the Times as well as for advertisers?
Yeah, brands have traditionally been wary of news media as advertising platforms because the demographic-based advertising placement is by algorithm. You don't know what kind of content your ad is going to be attached to. So YouTube has this problem as well. So this is basically trying to make them more comfortable with the platform that and being able to target their ads to particular content.
So the Times is doing this. Who else?
USA Today is doing it. ESPN is doing it to some degree. You know, they have a program where they track a sports fan's emotional condition during games. And so maybe if your team is losing, you won't see any ads at all.
So I guess this is when you're looking at the spectrum of what we can do with targeted ads, this feels a little less invasive, maybe, even though there's still something a little Orwellian about it.
Absolutely.
John Carroll, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's take another look at that bombshell UN report released this week that says humans are putting 1 million plant and animal species at risk of extinction. Today, the global population is more than 7.5 billion. By the end of the century, the UN says it will hit 11 billion. So is the natural world paying the price for the sheer number of human beings living on Earth? Let's hear two opinions. First, Robin Maynard, director of the UK-based group Population Matters. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Do you see a connection between what the UN report is telling us and the growth in global population?
Yes, I'm afraid I do. And it's not just this one UN report. There's been several over recent years which have made a very close correlation between what scientists are calling the sixth mass extinction, where wildlife, biodiversity, species other than our own across the world are in a state of crisis. Indeed, it's not just the numbers of people, it's our consumption of resources as well.
Sure.
But the numbers of humanity upon the Earth has been ignored for too long.
So is there a point then where we reach peak human when the Earth just can't hold anymore?
Well, that's a very good question. And at the moment, according to the UN statistics, there isn't a peak human graph. You know, it's continuing to grow, even though growth has slowed. There is, you know, it sounds tiny figures. It's sort of 1.1% growth overall. But that still means our population is set to double over 63 years. And the fertility rate, i.e. the numbers of children on average women have, has gone down to about 2.4, 2.5 across the world.
Right. In the 1950s, it was 5 or 6 kids.
Absolutely. So things seem to be going the right direction, but there's such an awful lot of us that actually turning around that critical mass of humanity so that we become in balance with all the other things we rely on the planet. You know, we're not divorced from nature. We need the atmosphere. We need clean water. We need fisheries, etc., etc. And we are eroding away the natural resource base upon which we depend, like every other species.
Look, this theory has been questioned before. I'm sure you know that in the 1960s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb that warned of mass starvation.
Yes.
And it never came true.
Yes. Thank goodness.
Yeah. So, but can't we adapt? No matter how many people are on Earth, can't we adapt? Which is what happened in that case. We started getting better at growing food.
For sure. We certainly can't go on forever. And Paul Ehrlich was perhaps ahead of his time. But even the father of the Green Revolution, a guy called Professor Norman Borlaug, said the only thing he had achieved through the Green Revolution, where they bred high-yielding varieties of crops, which were very responsive to fertilizers and pesticides, All he'd achieved was a breathing space for humanity to get our population in balance. So, yes, technology can sort of cut the onion a bit finer and get us out of an immediate jam, but it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter.
Do you think the solution is people having fewer children?
I think that is one of the solutions, and it's a critical solution which has been ignored. There was a wonderful piece of work done by Paul Hawken through the Project Drawdown. Their simple premise was, let's look at the top 100 available solutions to climate change that we can start doing now. And then they drilled that down to the top 10. At 6 and 7 were educating girls and family planning. And much to Paul Hawken's amazement, he said, when you combine those, they are the number one most effective solution and technology for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. They will save more greenhouse gas emissions each year than all onshore and offshore wind power combined. And yet I do not hear Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth or the Worldwide Fund for Nature championing the Project Drawdown report.
Isn't it kind of controversial, though? I mean, isn't that kind of controversial, though, to ask people to have fewer children if that's what they want and if that's what they need to do the work on the farm, for instance?
Well, it sounds like it, but it's of course a win-win solution because educating girls enables them to fulfill their life opportunities rather than having children at the age of 14 or 15 in some countries. It enables them to become much more entrepreneurial and independent in their society. It's something which is wanted. You know, it's a human right for women to have a choice over their fertility and their family size. But we also have to think as individuals. I mean, I've got two children. You know, I love them to bits. But as an environmentalist, I have to think, what's the impact of the size of my family, not just upon me and my family, but on the wider community and the wider world? So, yes, there are technological things we can do, but if we don't address our own species responsibly, then we are going to put ourselves in a very, very difficult situation.
That's Robin Maynard. He's director of the UK-based advocacy group Population Matters. Robin, thanks for having this conversation with us.
Pleasure.
And let's get another point of view from Jade Sasser. She's a professor at the University of California, Riverside, and author of the book On Infertile Ground, Population Control and Women's Rights in the Era of Climate Change. Professor, welcome. We just heard Robin Maynard say one solution to ease the human carbon footprint is to encourage women to have fewer babies. Do you agree?
Actually, I don't. The challenge is that population growth or size is not a direct corollary to what people do in the environment. So, for example, the United States accounts for approximately 4% of the global population, and yet it is responsible for around a quarter of the consuming and polluting activities on Earth, including polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. The other thing that I would add is that for women in Africa, I am certainly not against the full distribution of contraceptives. So we do know that women all over the world still don't have the full access to contraceptives and other reproductive services that they would like. What I am suggesting, however, is that providing full access to contraception in Africa will not solve our climate problem.
So you believe that family planning may be a part of this solution, but I wonder if you are concerned at all about some of the things that we've seen in the past. For instance, in the 1970s, fears of overpopulation were behind a program in India to sterilize millions of men, and that has happened more recently in India and in China, places around the globe. I mean, do you think that we are at some risk here with these conversations about overpopulation that something more coercive could happen?
Absolutely. I think we have always been at that risk, and that is something that I focus on closely in my book. So the book chronicles the history of how these scientific conversations around environmental conservation or preventing the spread or intensification of climate change, how these kinds of conversations have historically justified coercive population control measures that abuse human rights. And I'm very concerned that the return of a focus on overpopulation or human population numbers could also usher in these more coercive measures.
Can you give me some other examples that you've seen throughout history that alarm you?
Yes, well, right here in the United States, actually, there is a long history of population control. We tend to focus on countries like India or China. China, of course, is notorious for its one-child rule, which has led to a number of coercive abuses, including frequently sex-selective abortions and fining people for having more than two children. But right here in the United States, there is a long history of sterilizing low-income women, women of color, particularly those who are on welfare, without their knowledge or without their consent. So in the 1970s, there were a number of cases that became very popular in which minors as young as the ages of 12 went into the hospital or went to a clinic to receive other kinds of services, and they came out sterilized without their knowledge. So this is not just in the past, and it's not that far away from us.
I hear you. Obviously, that is not something anyone wants to see. But do you believe that population, global population, is not a threat to the natural world?
What I think is a threat to the natural world is overconsumption of resources. I really want to focus the attention there because in the places like the U.S., like China, like India, where we already see birth rates coming down, we still see an intensification of the consumption of resources, and we see an ongoing rapid acceleration of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. And so what I'm suggesting is that interventions into population growth in these places have not made a dent when it comes to the rapid pace of climate change. And I think we should really be focusing on the ways that we consume and the economic systems that drive that consumption.
That's Jade Sasser, professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of California, Riverside. Professor Sasser, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Starting this July in the United Kingdom, visitors to porn sites will have to show a government ID or volunteer their credit card information to prove they're old enough to access the adult content. The new rule, designed to keep kids from stumbling across porn on the internet, is the first of its kind and is raising privacy concerns in the UK. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how did this law come about?
So this particular law and the rule that we're talking about here got started by members of the UK's Conservative Party a few years ago during campaigning back in 2015 and 2016. It has gained steam ever since, and it's got a basis in preserving traditional cultural mores, right? The origin is pretty vague. It's part of this Digital Economy Act of 2017. It touches on everything from like lending out ebooks to selling tickets online and, of course, porn.
So how are they going to enforce it?
Great question. There's a pop-up page that's supposed to be on every one of these sites that does not feature porn and kind of forces users to jump over this wall. The British Board of Film Classification is supposed to check porn websites to make sure they're actually doing this. But really, it's the porn providers themselves that have to build the age check technology. So there's a bunch of different options floating around depending on where you're going for this content.
Do the porn providers think that they're going to lose customers because of this? Because people, even if they are of age, they're not going to want to give over their name and ID to get into the porn site?
This is a really good question. I think that there are some interesting aspects to this that could benefit some of these providers, right? So underlying all of this needing to provide a proof of identification as a person, these sites are going to be able to build the beginnings of what could be a paywall or payment technology. So yes, it's being sort of handed down by the government. Yes, these sites do have to do this, and I'm sure that they're not happy about having to build that technology. But at the same time, that technology could lead to a new profit stream or a new revenue stream of some of these sites.
Some porn sites already cost money.
Yeah, that's true. Although in the last probably 7 or 8 years, there's been a huge conglomerate called MindGeek that provides a lot of this content for free. And that's a whole other kind of fascinating story about how users online really want their content to be free. This is why so many sites, both adult and non-adult, are free and ad-supported. And pornography is no different.
And as has been said before, if you're getting something for free online, you're not the customer, you're the product.
Exactly. And I think, you know, again, a lot of these companies that are providing this, not only the third-party companies, but the pornography companies themselves are, I think, probably intrigued at the idea of getting more data on their users. Of course, the suggestion there will be, we're going to give you content that you're even more interested, the best of what you actually want. But of course, they're collecting data on you and leveraging that.
Are there ways that kids would be able to get around the age verification wall in the UK?
I feel like this is a story as old as time, Jeremy, in a way, right? Like, kids will always find a way to access content that is not for them. So yes, for sure, I think that will happen, you know, probably in some ways that nobody has even imagined yet. Also, this law doesn't seem to do much to address social media, and there's a lot of pornography already existing on various social media sites. There are also other things worth considering: virtual private networks or VPNs and so-called VPN tunneling. So as a user, you might pretend to be outside of the UK using this VPN technology in order to access this content.
Is there a lot of opposition to this new law?
I think it depends on who you ask, right? So I think there are a lot of users and consumer-focused organizations that are really concerned about privacy here, right? There are a lot of people who don't feel great about the idea of a pornography company having your personal identifying information. That company could be hacked. They could not have good data security protocols, and your personal information could be put right next to all of your porn browsing habits for everyone to see. So I think there are a lot of people concerned about that. But in general, I think there has been some political support for this, at least among those who support the Conservative Party in the UK, and that's why it survived this long.
Is something like this being talked about in the United States?
I haven't seen evidence of a conversation at this scale of this happening in the U.S., but if the U.K. does it successfully and it's deemed a huge, great success, then you might see the U.S. and other countries that are democracies considering this.
As it is right now, so many sites in the U.S., we now have to say, yes, I accept cookies because of the Europeans who required that.
Totally. And it would also be really interesting to see people logging into some of these sites with tools like Twitter or Facebook or something like that in order to identify them.
That's Ben Brock-Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.